Right now, we turn to South America and Colombia, where somewhere in the jungle, leftist guerrillas hold three Americans hostage. Keith Stansel, Mark Gonsalves, and Tom Howes fell into the hands of the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, when their plane crashed in February 2003 while on a mission to look for cocaine factories. They've been captive now for more than 4 years, and diplomatic efforts to gain their release have stalled. Joshua Hammer is a Berlin-based journalist who visited Colombia to write about the hostages for the December issue of Men's Vogue, and he joins us now on the line from Berlin. Thanks for taking the time tonight.
You're welcome, Neil.
First of all, what were these men doing in Colombia?
These men were contracted they were employees of Northrop Grumman, which is one of the biggest U.S. defense contractors. And at that time, Northrop Grumman had about an $8 million contract with the Defense Department to survey the jungles of Colombia for hidden cocaine factories. So they were out flying over jungles, over mountains, taking photographs, surveying the terrain, and then delivering that information to the U.S. Embassy, which would then identify these spots and send out the Colombian Army to eradicate the coke factories.
And the FARC controls big areas of Colombian jungle, and your article describes how in flights they would be regularly fired at by FARC guerrillas.
Yes, exactly. The FARC's major moneymaker, and one of the reasons they've managed to stay in business as a guerrilla force for so long, is the cocaine industry, which they control a large part of in Colombia. And I'd point out that none of these guys really knew when they went down there that they were going to be involved and was essentially a counterinsurgency operation, which in fact it turned out to be.
And you also write that the aircraft they were using was really inadequate.
Exactly. That was a big running source of contention between some of the more outspoken members of the program and Northrop Grumman, their employer. There were stormy meetings. There was a letter sent from a couple of the pilots to the company saying, hey, we're flying a single-engine Cessna here over very difficult terrain. The FARC is firing at us. These engines are not all that reliable. At least give us a twin engine if we're going to be doing this kind of work. And they were regularly ignored. And in fact, one of the pilots was demoted after making trouble, accused of being disloyal.
Now, was the plane shot down when it crashed?
The plane was not shot down. It developed engine failure. There had been an incident a couple of years earlier, where the same plane had had a catastrophic engine failure while flying over the Caribbean, and the pilot managed to get it back to an airstrip safely. The exact same phenomenon happened 2 years later. They were flying over the jungle. They were about to actually land for refueling when the engine just died. And the same pilot, in fact, at the wheel, was able to make another spectacular landing on a cleared coca field on a hillside. So he got the plane down without killing anybody. But, of course, they were immediately – it turned out to be in the heart of FARC country, and they were immediately surrounded.
And there were five people on the plane at the time.
Yes, the pilot was killed, in fact. He was shot dead, Tom Janis, along with a Colombian military intelligence officer who was along for the ride. There was always a Colombian accompanying these flights. So both of these men were killed. It's still unclear exactly why, but the other three survived with minor injuries, and they were immediately surrounded and marched off on what turned out to be a 3 or 4 week hike to the first of many jungle encampments where they've been ever since.
You mentioned cocaine, a big cash earner for FARC. Another one, at least traditionally, has been hostages.
Well, that's true. There have been thousands of hostages taken by the FARC. However, this particular group, along with several dozen others who are considered quote-unquote high-value hostages, are not being held for ransom. These guys are being held as bargaining chips for some sort of political solution. That's one of the reasons that this thing has lingered for so long. And most of these hostage situations are settled in a matter of weeks or months with cash being paid by the families or whoever. But the FARC isn't interested in that this time around.
They want political concessions. But
exactly.
Let's talk for a moment about the conditions in which they live. You got an extraordinary account of their lives from another former hostage, John Pinchao, who escaped from the FARC camp where he was being held with the Americans. He has a description of their daily lives, which is it's difficult. You describe it as an Alcatraz-like existence in the middle of the jungle.
It's a pretty dreary life. It's pretty unchanging. The only real changes in their lives occur when they are forced to move camp for whatever reason, and they venture on these days or week-long jungle hikes to a new place. But it's pretty dreary, pretty regimented. Of course, there are the chains, as Pinchot said, was the worst part of it. They are chained at night. They're chained through the night until they wake up in the morning. They're chained when they move from camp to camp. They're chained when they go down to the river to bathe. The rest of their time is basically spent eating, resting, playing team sports, working out, reading. But it's kind of an existence. It's not really a life as one would expect in this kind of situation. And it's been going on for actually almost 5 years now.
Almost 5 years.
1,700 days like this. It's really kind of hard to imagine.
A hostage crisis that long, and it seems as if very few people have heard of it.
Well, yeah, that's true. I think that Latin America is not exactly on the North American radar screen these days. Ever since 9/11, of course, our focus has been elsewhere. There is possibly the fact that these guys are military contractors, and so perhaps there may be something to that we're focusing far less on them because they are military contractors and therefore are maybe seen to have been these kind of gung-ho macho guys who were out doing dangerous things. In fact, these guys were not particularly gung-ho or macho. They were, as I said, they weren't really expecting to be caught up in a war. They were lured to a fairly dangerous area because the money was good. But I would also posit that the U.S. government isn't wildly happy about drawing any attention to this situation because it reveals a certain impotence. I mean, this has been going on for 5 years, and really very little has been accomplished. I mean, the last initiative we had was President Chavez of Venezuela getting involved in an attempt to upstage the Americans,
and upstage his rival President Uribe of Colombia,
and upstage Uribe as well. Yeah.
And that came to nothing.
It came to nothing, but I think there was a lot of misplaced hope in that to begin with. Chavez met with a lot of the family members of the hostages, and from what my conversations with these people indicated, that they liked him and trusted him and thought he was sincere, but he was insisting that one of the key conditions for the release of these men would be that the United States would have to turn over two FARC commanders who were extradited to the United States, put on trial there, and sentenced to long terms for kidnapping and drug conspiracy. And there's no way the United States is going to let those guys out of prison or send them back to Colombia. So essentially, Chavez's initiative was a non-starter, but now it's moot anyway because he's out of it.
And has withdrawn his ambassador to Colombia as part of the part of the
so
fallout.
It's really back to square one, I'm afraid. It's just, and most people I've talked to said they doubt that anything's really going to happen in this case until Uribe leaves power, which is not going to happen until 2010. People seem to think that this thing's going to drag on at least another 3 years.
The State Department says the United States does not negotiate with terrorists.
Yeah, the U.S. has played a hard line on this, and it's unclear what exactly the U.S. is doing. Of course, there's an awful lot of anger and feelings of betrayal among some of the family members who think that the U.S. Abandoned these guys in the jungle, that had they been real soldiers, they would never have been allowed to rot away like this. There is some validity to the argument. I've talked to guys within the high-level people within the State Department who were there on the ground when these guys went down, who said, yes, it's true, had they been soldiers, had they been men in uniform, it's probable that there would have been a greater effort both ahead of time and after the fact to make sure that this kind of a situation could never happen. But the fact that they were military contractors, these people said, meant that they were to a certain extent expendable, which is really quite sad.
One other celebrity hostage, if you will, being held by the FARC, Ingrid Betancourt, the Colombian politician. And the description you received about her was remarkable.
I actually met Ingrid Betancourt in 2000. 2000, about a year or so before she was kidnapped, and I found her to be a very feisty, very tough, courageous woman. So to hear that she had been, that she had cursed her guards, that she had actually slapped one of them in the face, that she had tried to escape five times and each time was dragged back and kept in chains for several days, didn't really surprise me, given what I know about this woman. A couple of FARC people I talked to, or former FARC guerrillas who had been reintegrated, said that they didn't really believe the story about the slap in the face. They said that had any hostage slapped a FARC guard in the face, it would have been grounds for immediate execution. So they were somewhat skeptical about the portrayal of her as being as tough and defiant as she was made out to be by Pinchel. But I think she certainly has not sat down and accepted this passively.
Of course, in addition to ransoming hostages either for political concessions or for cash, the FARC has been known to kill a few.
They have, and I think that that is one of the reasons that the rescue option, which I so often heard about, bandied about when I was down in Colombia, has not been exercised. There have been a couple of attempts over the past years to mount rescue operations on other FARC encampments where hostages have been held. They tend to end badly. There was one incident where every hostage was killed.
I'm afraid we're out of time, but thanks very much.
You're quite welcome.
Joshua Hammer, a journalist based in Berlin. His story, Bungle in the Jungle, appears in the December issue of Men's Vogue, and you can find it through a link at our website, npr.org/blogofthenation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Regular listeners know we usually read from your letters every Tuesday afternoon. We ran out of time yesterday, so this week it's Wednesday, the day we read from your emails and blog comments. We talked a week ago about the push to update the Montgomery GI Bill and offer veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan more money for college. It's a change many listeners agreed with, including Arden, who emailed, "My Vietnam-era GI benefits allowed me 2 years of undergraduate training and allowed me to earn a graduate degree, though I did have to work summers and some part-time jobs. The present woefully inadequate Veterans Administration educational benefits should be an absolute embarrassment to all of us whose continued safety and security flows directly from the sacrifice of our present brave and honorable service members." Another listener saw it very differently. "When the bill was first enacted, a large segment of the armed forces were drafted," wrote Sarah Jacobs in South Carolina. "Today, people are choosing to join. As a taxpayer, I resent the fact that I'm working and going to school, but the people that choose to join the military not only expect to get paid and receive full benefits while in the military, but want full college tuition to whatever school they get into and a living subsistence. It's not my responsibility, nor should the United States go even further into debt just because you feel like you should get even more reward for the job you chose to take. An education is a privilege, not a right. On Thanksgiving Day, we gorged on gadgets, all the gizmos you'd like to see in your stocking this year. We heard from a caller who said he was blind and could not find a cell phone that was accessible. Amir emailed us from Tehran in Iran with this tip. Being visually impaired, I myself use a screen reader called Talks. Talks is produced by Nuance Communications and makes many Nokia cell phones almost completely accessible. The website for information, nuance.com/talks. And thanks, Amir, for the advice. And speaking of advice, a number of listeners had some for G. Willow Wilson. She's the author of the new graphic novel Cairo. During our interview, she mentioned in passing that the Nile is the only river in the world that runs south to north. Oh, did we get emails. Alan Carroll knows a thing or two about this. He's chief cartographer for National Geographic and joins us now on the line from his office a couple of blocks from here in Washington, D.C. Alan, nice of you to be with us today.
Thanks, Neil. Nice to be here.
And the Nile is not the only river that flows south to north, is it?
Not by any means. There are many rivers around the world that flow south to north.
And I guess the list off the top of my head should begin with the Athabasca and go to, there's probably one that begins with Z.
I don't know about a Z, but there's a Mackenzie River in Canada, and the Oder and Vistula in Europe, and the Ob and Lena in Asia, and more and more.
And why do you think so many people have the perception that rivers generally flow south?
Well, I've been thinking about that. I think maybe it has a lot to do with the fact that most people on this planet happen to live in the central and southern portions of three big continents, North America, Europe, and Asia. And since we live there, and since we're in those parts of the continents, most rivers in those areas flow toward the sea, which tends to be to the south, east, or west. So not too many are flowing north.
Do you wonder if we're perhaps in thrall to wall maps and the idea that a river flows up the wall is perfectly crazy?
Well, that's certainly part of it. Of course, up on a wall map represents north for the most part on the surface of the Earth. And, of course, the surface of the Earth is more or less horizontal. So up is very different on a map than it is on the ground.
But in terms of the way rivers actually flow, direction doesn't have anything to do with it, does it?
That's right. In fact, even on up on a map is really only a convention. We could just as easily print our maps with south up. It really doesn't, it's just the way we're used to looking at the world.
It's a round world after all.
That's right.
Okay. Alan Carroll, thanks very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Alan Carroll is a cartographer, in fact, the chief cartographer for National Geographic, and joined us from his office here in Washington. If you have comments, questions, or corrections for us, the best way to reach us is by email. The address is talk@npr.org. Please let us know where you're writing from and give us some help on how to pronounce your name. Talk of the Nation is produced by Susan Lund, Enrique Rivera, David Gura, Ashley Grashaw, Dahlia Martinez, and Barry Hardiman. Our editor is Scott Cameron. Beth Novi produces our web content, and our intern is Kate Brandley. Gwen Uten directs the program. Assistant producer, Sarah Handel. Drew Reynolds is our technical director. He gets engineering help from Jerry Tennant and John Widoff. Talk of the Nation's theme music was composed by Greg Smith. Our senior producer is Carlene Watson. Sue Goodwin is the executive producer. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.